Welcome to the Economics Explored podcast. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. I'm a professional economist working in Brisbane, Australia, and I'm a former Australian Treasury official. This is episode 74 on industry assistance and crony capitalism. My guest today is Darren Brady Nelson, Chief Economist of Liberty Works, which is an Australian libertarian think tank, and Darren's also a policy advisor at the Heartland Institute. Darren, thanks for appearing on this program for the sixth time.
Oh, thank you for having me. Am I setting a new record, or is there someone who's ahead of me?
I think you are setting a new record, Darren. Yes, absolutely. So I know I've chatted with my friend Tim possibly five times. Let me check that, but I think you probably are setting the record. Always interested in what you have to say about different issues. And I thought we could chat about this whole idea of industry assistance and corporate welfare. Sometimes I hear this term crony capitalism. I'd like to explore these with you because I know you've been doing a lot of thinking about these over the years and you've written on them. Like me, you've been involved in industry policy in government. So you worked in the New South Wales Treasury and you dealt with incentives for the film industry there. I worked in the industry policy unit in the Australian Treasury and I looked at film industry incentives and incentives for other industries. So we used to protect the car industry in Australia when we had a domestic car industry. Unfortunately, it couldn't stand on its own two feet. It needed to be propped up by government at the cost of hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So I know we've both got that experience. And I was prompted to do this, to have this as a topic, because last week I was invited to speak to an ABC journalist here in Australia on this new incentive. So the federal government here is offering all of these new incentives. There's this new location incentive. If you spend money in Australia on film productions, you get a tax break, and international productions such as the new Thor, Love and Thunder, they're able to take advantage of this. And there's always a question about whether this type of assistance makes sense or not and whether Australians get anything out of it. I'm not a great believer in it. Darren, to kick off, could you give us a flavour of, like, what's your experience with industry assistance and generally what you think about industry assistance? And then we might get into some of the specifics on the film industry, please.
Well, as you alluded to, I guess I first got exposed to industry assistance in my first job of New South Wales Treasury, when I was mainly doing economic policy, in particular focusing on national competition policy, which included things like trying to reduce things like industry assistance. So at Treasury, you have the kind of, you face this. So I'm doing competition policy, but at the same time, I'm also doing kind of general economic policy work, which included dealing with the then Department of State and Regional Development, who was pretty much their main job was trying to dole out subsidies to various industries. And at that time, in the sort of mid to late 90s, one of the things that came across my desk was the possibility of getting a subsidy to establish Fox Studios. That was probably the first thing in Australia like that I can recall. At least, an international sort of, it wouldn't be the first time that there was sort of film subsidies. They've probably been doing that in Victoria and elsewhere with local. But Fox was obviously a big American or / international company coming in. And, that was a chance to kind of look at kind of the principles behind subsidies and, the various arguments on, why you should have them or why you shouldn't have them, a bit of cost benefit analysis type thinking as well. So, Treasury came down on the side of, we didn't think it was a good idea, but we lost that debate in the political arena, as you often do, particularly, obviously with well-connected players, and particularly if it's kind of glamorous, because film industry still has a glamorous side to it. Because, in fairness, often the subsidies that they're asking for is pretty small compared to things like rail or, the utilities and other industries that aren't so glamorous yet. Obviously you and I worked on that paper. What was that? It was for
the Australian Taxpayers Alliance, was it?
Yeah, that's right. We're, you know, we looked at kind of 10 pretty bad budget expenditures by the Queensland government over the course of like a decade or so, which included the film stuff, but, you know, they were actually relatively small compared to some other stuff. But, you know, they're sort of public good, their externality arguments are quite weak though, compared to some of the other, you know, more traditional or, you know, industries.
Okay. So yeah, lots of good points there, Darren. I should note that, yeah, the assistance to industries across Australia has fallen over the years because we're no longer subsidising the car industry or textile clothing and footwear industries as we once did. We originally supported them with tariffs. We cut those. We replaced them with subsidies, and it turned out they couldn't survive on their own. So generally the amount has come, the level of subsidies for industries, it appears to have fallen, but there are some industries which seem to still do very well. So you mentioned, is it utilities? I mean, we're subsidising a lot of consumers or irrigators, aren't we, sometimes? And regional businesses, they benefit from subsidised water and electricity to an extent. I think we discovered that. That's one of the ways that...
Probably the chief area that, you know, in the paper, I kind of discuss kind of, you know, the different forces behind these things. You know, there's big business is commonly, you know, one of the forces, and that would include, you know, film industry and a whole bunch of others. The bureaucracy itself is often looking, you know, particularly if you have departments that are devoted to that, you know, looking to dole out subsidies. And probably the chief one over the past 10 plus years has been the climate change industry. You know, which, you know, chief amongst them is renewable energy, but also includes, as we all recall, those desalination plants, you know, which were hugely expensive. You know, and that has a different dynamic than obviously what the film industry is pushing, you know, for their reasons for a subsidy. You know, they are obviously, the film industry is not pushing a existential threat to society as, you know, the climate change industry is. The climate change subsidies are massive, you know, and so those haven't gone down. They've gone up, you know, state and federal. But they offer a great illustration how, you know, renewables, just like all these other subsidized industries, never get weaned off the subsidies. They don't tend to lower their subsidies to a point. And I've heard many people claim that renewables are becoming more efficient. No, they're not. You know, I've never seen any great evidence for that. The fact that the price of something goes down is expected when the subsidies keep on going up and up and up. So, you know, just like the car manufacturers, you know, they sowed the seeds of their destruction by taking the subsidies in the first place. You know, so whether they were ever able to stand on their own feet, we'll never know, because once you become a subsidized industry, you're stuck there. You know, it's like being trapped on welfare, you know. That's the term corporate welfare. There's a lot of parallels with just normal welfare.
Yeah. So one of the great challenges, I think, Darren, is working out where there could be a legitimate case for some sort of assistance, because, like, you're identifying the heavy subsidies that there are for renewables. So the proponents of renewables will argue, well, we do have to worry about climate change, and we're subsidising renewables because there's a public good associated with them. And with the film industry, if we might be good to go back to the film industry, we might have to deal with renewables in another episode, because it's a huge topic.
Renewables run the standard neoclassical arguments for on externalities, more externalities than public goods. But, you know, sometimes that's also brought in for some industries. But yeah, film struggles a bit more to make those arguments.
Well, what's annoyed me about the assistance to these big budget international productions, or like Thor, Love and Thunder, or Pirates of the Caribbean, or I think Dora the Explorer, they're not really adding anything to Australian culture. So you can't really make that public good argument. It's not like back in the 70s when you had the South Australian Film Corporation and it was funding films such as, I think it was Picnic at Hanging Rock and Sunday Too Far Away. These stories, which are great Australian stories, like, I can't see any public benefit out of our assistance to the film industry. So what they argue is that, well, it's important for establishing this infant industry. So supporting this infant industry will develop these new businesses, all these skilled people in Australia. So it will end up with a thriving film industry that can stand on its own two feet one day. And I've been very sceptical. So I think you were sort of suggesting that with the car industry. Would you agree generally with that, Darren? Could there be any case for this infant industry argument?
Yeah, look, you're spot on. That as I recall, with Fox Studios, that was kind of their primary argument. Obviously, they couldn't argue the cultural things. They obviously weren't trying to argue some, you know, pollution type externality stuff, which obviously doesn't have anything to do with the film industry. So yeah, it was that infant industry stuff. And you know, look, the literature is pretty damning against that. You know, the infant industry, you know, like obviously Nobel laureate economists like Milton Friedman have been, you know, squashed that many times, that, you know, the infant industries just never grow up. They just, like I said, it, you know, the fact that you start taking these subsidies, you know, it just ensures that you just, you're disincentivized to really ever grow up. You stay an infant. Just, you know, like I said, there's actually great parallels. And I'm not sure if, you know, I'm sure someone's done it, but, you know, sort of looked at some of those parallels with just normal welfare and all the downsides of normal welfare that disincentivize people to, you know, sort of like really get out of their situation of welfare. I think corporates are exactly the same. We don't have the same sympathy, and we probably shouldn't, obviously, as we would for, you know, like a person or a family caught in welfare for multiple generations. You know, there's certainly, you know, some deserved empathy for them, whereas for the corporates, obviously, they certainly don't deserve any empathy and they don't usually get it. But their argument, you know, like I said, this is like 96, 97 that I'm talking about the Fox Studio stuff, and this industry still hasn't grown up in Australia.
Yeah.
So and if someone wants to make a plausible infant industry argument, I would like to see at least the time frame. You know, tell me what's the time frame and give me the path towards the less and less subsidies. I've never seen that, you know, and I don't think we'll ever see that.
Exactly. Now, you mentioned the Fox Studios in Sydney. So at the same, I think around the same time, the Queensland government was talking with Village Roadshow, and they set up Movie World, and they've got production facilities there on the Gold Coast. And so they've made films there such as, the one I remember, I think, is Scooby-Doo. One of my previous guests on this program, Tim Hughes, worked on that production. And I think, a few others. Yeah, so we were chatting about money on the screen, getting the best return on investment.
So Phil, Scooby-Doo didn't really contribute to Australian culture too much?
well, I don't think so.
I don't think it really contributed to even American culture all that much. But,
well,
taste, but I mean, I happen to like the Thor movies, but I don't support Australian taxpayers subsidizing it.
No, but one of the things we discovered in that paper that we wrote for that Australian Taxpayers Alliance volume on, was it the Galar Awards? I think you actually went to the awards, didn't you?
And it was part of the Friedman Conference, so it was kind of just a subset, you know, that they announced the awards during the dinner. So we didn't win, sadly, but it was a good dinner.
Yes. So one of the items we identified was the state government here, it paid $14 million for a new soundstage for Village Roadshow a few years ago. And the idea was, oh, we'll need it for the Commonwealth Games. So I think it was used maybe a couple of times for Commonwealth Games, but it's just been gifted to Village Roadshow. So it's like a $14 million or so gift to a corporation. And you just have to wonder whether that makes sense or not. Darren, I'm wondering, have you been following what's happening in the States there? Because I know that Louisiana at different times has offered, you know, very generous tax incentives to production. So, I mean, Hollywood's incredibly good at playing these governments off against each other, isn't it, and trying to get the best deal it can whether that's in another state in the US, whether it, I don't know what Canada does, but I know that in Australia we offer very generous incentives. And I noticed that there was this great story in the, well, really informative story in The Advocate, which is a paper in Louisiana. And it says, film tax break costs Louisiana millions. New study shows supporters rally at entertainment summit. Okay, despite changes made by lawmakers to rein in the state's film tax credit, taxpayers still lose roughly two-thirds of the money they put into the program. I'll put this link in the show notes. New preliminary figures unveiled on Thursday show for every dollar spent on the tax credit programs for the entertainment industry in Louisiana, mainly the film tax credit, state and local governments get about 36 cents back in tax revenue, said Michael Nadolo, vice president for New York-based Kamoan Associates, which conducted the study for Louisiana Economic Development. Are you across what's happening in the States, Darren? Or does that study surprise you? It doesn't surprise me. I think that it sounds pretty plausible to me.
Well, look, you're right. It seems like Hollywood, and obviously Hollywood's not alone. I mean, obviously Hollywood is literally strictly a particular industry, but it's not easily identifiable. That's kind of a vaguer term. But I think there's a lot of film companies, Fox and all these others, who do run around the U.S. and they run around the world because not just for films, but TV, you know, like a lot of TV shows in particular have been filmed in Vancouver in Canada. I don't know the specifics, but I'm pretty sure at the minimum they're giving tax breaks, but they very well, you know, given Canada's history is very similar to Australia, they're probably giving actual subsidies. So you raise a very interesting point, and this is where different schools of thought differ. So the neoclassical approach kind of sees a tax break and a subsidy as pretty much the same thing, whereas Chicago and Austrian school go, it's not exactly the same thing. A subsidy requires you taking tax from someone else and then doling it out. Whereas, you know, someone like Rothbard would point out, well, you're just actually paying less tax. So the way that newspaper piece is worded is actually, it's not accurate, or, you know, in some cases, because I have a lot of friends, as you probably do, on the left side of politics, it's basically disingenuous. They try to say, you know, like this whole debate on, you know, when the oil industry is being subsidized, what they actually mean is we think they should pay more tax than they do, but they're not. So I don't know in Louisiana's circumstance, they're saying tax credit. That doesn't actually sound like a subsidy. Debate to have about, you know, whether tax credits are good, because you are ultimately skewing, you know, the playing field.
Yeah.
To me, a tax credit is a different thing. It's worth a discussion and a debate, but it's not the same thing as actually taking taxpayers' money and doling it out to someone.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, the way that we used to think about this in the Treasury, and I'm guessing you would have in New South Wales Treasury too, is that we'd prefer any type of tax incentives like this to be economy-wide, to be across all industries. We don't want them specific to an industry. So I think the problem with the what's done in Louisiana and our Australian film tax incentives, and also in Canada, I just did some quick Googling and it says there's a Canadian film or video production tax credit which provides eligible productions with a fully refundable tax credit available at a rate of 25% of the qualified labour expenditure. So that's similar to in Australia. Okay, so it's industry specific, and so you talked about it could mean that the playing field's not level. Did Rothbard say anything about that? Like, what did he say? Okay, well, I don't like these ones that are industry specific. I don't mind cutting taxes or providing tax credits, but it should be available to all industries.
Well, you know, Rothbard's, you know, very, you know, about as free market as you can get. So his view was, you know, anytime the government's taking less money from you, doesn't matter who it is, whether it's a specific human being or a specific business or a specific industry, he was for it. And he went through with his analysis on why that actually is good for an economy. I agree, ideally, you know, for, you know, to give, if you're going to be giving tax breaks to try to give them as widely as possible, rather than, you know, through backroom deals, you know, obviously these kind of smoke-filled room deals that, you know, some, you know, industries get or certain big businesses get. But I think, yeah. So, I mean, look, it's not a straightforward argument. There's good evidence on both sides, you know. But I think clearly, you know, the main point I wanted to make was definitely that, you know, a tax break is not the same thing as a subsidy. I think a subsidy is worse than any tax break, whether you think it's too targeted or too niche for, you know, someone yeah. like Hollywood. I think a subsidy is like a double whammy. You know, it's probably a triple whammy because, you know, you're taking out of the private, out of the productive private sector. Bureaucrats are handling it and they're getting some of it anyway. So they're taking a cut and then giving it out to, you know, a favored, well-connected people who probably lobbied for that. So, you know, there's kind of other resources in the economy that, you know, sort of like a crony capitalist often operates in a market that's less competitive, you know. So, you know, they're kind of wasting resources, basically, more so.
Okay, just to be clear, when you talk about the bureaucracy,
you know, public choice stuff in there, you know, this yeah. there's resources being wasted instead of being put into productive activities. It's put into, you know, rent seeking essentially.
Yeah, but when you talk about bureaucrats taking a cut or getting a cut of it, you don't mean they're actually. You don't mean explicit corruption, although you're talking about
they're taking a legal cut. You know, by the fact that this is their job, you know, this, you know, they're working for the Department of State Development or something. So they're taking that, you know, well, look, there's obviously been examples of illegal cuts being taken too, or including the stuff that's on the edge, whereas, you know, all of a sudden the bureaucrat leaves to go work as a lobbyist for that, you know, so, you know, that probably isn't technically illegal, but I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's kind of certainly uneconomic and certainly unethical as well that goes on here. So yeah, look, I'm not a big fan, you know, like, you know, when people get a tax cut, obviously it's a bit more straightforward that we can be happy with, you know, like when the Queensland public or the Australian public gets a tax cut of their income or something, their income taxes, you know, that's a bit straightforward thing. We can agree that that's usually a pretty good thing. And yes, you know, I tend to favor, you know, if you're going to give tax cuts to business, let's do it across the board through the corporate tax cuts or small, you know, like small business tax cuts, rather than, you know, specific, very specific things like, you know, film producers who want to make four, you know, in Queensland.
Yeah.
But it is economically quite a different thing, a tax break versus an actual subsidy.
Okay. I can imagine it'd be good fun working in some of these bodies such as Screen Australia or Screen Queensland. You possibly get invited to some of these red carpet events. I know, like, I've always suspected that part of the attraction that politicians have for assisting the film industry is, and you mentioned the glamour of the industry, it's being able to attend those events. So our premier here, Anastasia Palaszczuk, she can appear on the red carpet with Chris Hemsworth, right, from Thor.
She could be, like, squeezing his bicep and stuff in photos.
Oh, huge PR advantage. And we're paying for it. And they argue, oh, well, it's for jobs. But sometimes they're temporary jobs. And we all know, as economists, we talk about crowding out. So, I mean, what ends up happening is people, you know, they'll go and work on a film production for a few months or whatever, and they won't do their personal training job or their job at the local cafe. So the actual net benefit to the economy is not, I don't think it's that.
Well, it's worse because, again, you know, in the case where they're doling out a subsidy, they've had to take that from productive businesses who are going to hire less. You know, sort of Frederick Bastiat and talking about, you know, the seen and the unseen, you know, the good economists are the ones who think about the unseen impacts, you know, like, okay, you created these couple jobs here. Well, what are the jobs that perhaps you took away to get those two jobs? And often it's like three for, you know, jobs gone for every two you create, if not worse.
Yeah. Good point. I'll put a link to some info on Bastiat in the show notes. And just on this issue of tax credit versus subsidy, I agree with you. Generally, I think that's a good distinction to make. What I would note is because these tax credits here, they're refundable, so you can get this money even if you're not paying any tax, right? So like what I've never figured out is to what extent Australia is gaining tax. Like how much do we get back? Screen Australia doesn't report it from what I can tell. I remember I've emailed them in the past trying to get information out of them when I was writing that article for the CIS because I noticed, well, this incentive is refundable, which means that even if you have even if you're not paying any tax, you could still get a cash payment from the tax office.
So it's like a delayed subsidy then.
Yeah, it could be. But you see, we just don't know what they're actually – are they actually paying tax in excess of that that credit? So, I mean, how the tax system normally works is that I mean, you pay tax on your earnings. So after your expenses, your net income. But if that's zero, then I mean, what could happen is you get some sort of credit, and it can reduce your tax liability to zero. But there could be some of that credit left. Normally, you wouldn't get that. They wouldn't then pay you money. They'd just say, oh, you don't owe us any tax. But with refundable tax credits, you can actually get that additional credit, if you know what I mean. I'll have to put a link to
it's then magically, you know, turning into an actual subsidy.
Well, that's what I've suspected, and I'd like to see the evidence from the Screen Australia on that, but so far it hasn't been forthcoming. Anyway, that's been a good discussion, Darren. Before we go, I might ask you about this idea of crony capitalism. We hear this concept of crony capitalism a lot. Generally, I think, look, there are obviously examples of corruption out there, and there are industries that are, you know, lobbying for things that help them out. Australia and even the US, I think we're not like the kleptocracies in Africa, in some African countries, where you do have these, you know, failed nation states almost. And I mean, that really does, wreck your economy, destroy your living standards if you do have that kleptocracy. I think we do have generally good institutions, but there are concerns about corruption and some industries, you know, getting special deals. So I'm interested in your thoughts on this idea of crony capitalism. How do you define crony capitalism, and how concerned are you about crony capitalism?
It's not easy to define. It's essentially, it's capitalism where you look and you see these businesses and corporations, and they tend to be large, but actually the main defining characteristic is they tend to succeed by and large, or certainly in great part, due to the help of government, right? So that includes subsidies, tax credits, and probably the hardest one to wrap your head, you know, for people to wrap their heads around is all the regulatory favors, right? The, you know, the sort of the regulations that on the surface, you know, they've been sold to the public as, you know, we're going to keep these businesses or industry under control through regulations. But in fact, it was those businesses who actually initiated the regulations, because the point of them is to make, you know, life difficult for their competitors, right? That's kind of, you know, the upshot. And then that's actually what happens with subsidies as well, ultimately. Crony capitalism is about, you know, really avoiding competition and monopolizing your market as much as possible. It's a way to, you know, essentially easy profits through rent seeking rather than having to be productive and compete out in the free market.
Right. So,
it's a system that's been, you know, growing, you know, very rapidly over the past 100 years, but, you know, certainly had, you know, some of its foundations a little bit in the late 1800s.
Yes. I'm just trying to think of some examples of that. So, I mean, I guess a while back.
Well, the railway company, you know, yeah. They put in things like, you know, Standard Oil and stuff like that. But, you know, for the most part, you know, Standard Oil certainly dominated its marketplace, but, you know, it wasn't really, you know, like a proper crony capitalist, you know, it wasn't really getting government favors. The railways, like, for instance, in the, you know, Australia is a bit different because the railways were, you know, heavily had, you know, government really blatantly involved, right? You know, whereas in the U.S., it looked like these were private companies, and they were, but they were getting free land.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's, you know, like who, you know, that's crony, you know, that's like kind of the beginning stages of crony capitalism, when the government essentially gives you something for free, i.e. land. You know, that's why, you know, in many cases they overbuilt railways, or they had multiple railways next to each other, because, you know, free land, you know, they weren't facing the full costs of, you know, that they should have in their businesses to start out with. Not to mention, you know, the end of the Indian Wars and, you know, moving Indians out of the way as well. So, you know, that's all kind of sort of government stepping in the early stages. And then the U.S. also had sort of canal building and stuff like that was kind of an early form of crony capitalism as well.
Yeah. And it's where the...
But it really started to take off, you know, sort of 1913, World War One onwards.
Yeah, and it's where the capitalist has some type of influence or can use money to buy influence. And I've often wondered about, I mean, the one we talk about in Australia all the time is Murdoch and Fox. And I think there was a special deal between, was it with Foxtel and Telstra? So, I mean, Foxtel's had a special place, or it's had a competitive advantage in cable in Australia. And now we've got News Corporation. It's one of the big lobbyists for this new bargaining code with that will help them get money out of Google and Facebook. Now, that's I find that a challenging one, because I can see their point of view, and I think, you know, Google and Facebook are like they're doing incredibly well, and it look and all of that, a lot of that money's going out of Australia, so they're foreign companies. And so there could be some benefit in what the ACCC is proposing to rebalance the playing field, and so that Google and Facebook might have to pay, they'd have to pay money to News Corporation, but also to ABC, SBS, Fairfax 9. So I found that a difficult one to think about. Do you have any thoughts on that, Darren? Have you looked into that? Do you have any thoughts on, like, how should we weigh up these competing claims of, say, a News Corporation versus Google and Facebook?
Yeah, well, look, I think it's simple in some ways. It's not simple politically, but economically. You know, history and I think sound economics shows that, you know, you don't correct the bad outcomes from a government favor by then looking for another offsetting, balancing government favor. And this is exactly what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, like, so, you know, Google, Facebook, et cetera, got the big U.S. government favor of Section 230. And then, you know, I mean, the best way is obviously to remove Section 230, the same, you know. So, you know, people like Bastiat, et cetera, point out how, you know, this just keeps on going. This is a never-ending process. Things get more inefficient, more unethical as you go on, as you pile more and more, you know, the antitrust authorities, ACCC, really, they don't have a great history of, you know, ever delivering actual free market competition to a market, right? And they tend to focus on, you know, again, they never talk about, you know, the thing that really, where did these people get the ability to have this market power? And it, you know, 99 out of 100 times it came from some government crony style favor, right? To bring you back into history, again, with the 1800s, the utilities, which, you know, have been subsequently labeled as national monopolies, all started out in very competitive markets in the U.S. Gas, electricity, et cetera, all competing, you know, within cities, in states, across states, et cetera. What changed? The well-connected ones lobbied government to basically bring in franchise monopolies. You know, instead of, it's just too chaotic. The competition's too cutthroat. You know, the term they use, cutthroat competition.
Yeah, yeah.
basically means I can't handle it anymore, and I'm going to go off to government and look for a favor. And they basically got their monopoly franchises. And the trade-off for that was to then put in place the monopoly regulation that we have today, including what the ACCC does. So, you know, ultimately the best way to deal with it is to remove the government favors, and then you don't need the ACCC stepping in.
Okay. Darren, before we go, is there anything we've missed? I remember while we were chatting about what we could talk about this episode, you sent me that famous matrix from Milton Friedman. What did you want to say about that?
Oh, look, it's just that, you know, if any of your listeners, you know, obviously it's an all-time classic book on, you know, introducing people to the ideas of free market economics and liberty more generally. His book, Free to Choose, I think written and published in 1979 or thereabouts. And he's got a great matrix. It kind of just sums up, if you like, the problem with government and the problem with crony capitalism, you know, where he has... what is it? He's got these kind of this matrix of you know, whose money are you spending and whose money are you spending on? So, you know, there's a sort of a quadrant, one of where you spend your money on yourself. You have the most incentive to sort of like reduce the cost and maximize the value. Then there's a quadrant two where you spend someone else's where you spend your money on someone else, you know, like giving a gift. And then there's a quadrant three where you spend someone else's money on yourself. And then there's the fourth quadrant where it's someone else's money on someone else. So that's the bureaucrats, you know, doling out the money to film companies. And the film companies are in quadrant three where, you know, they're basically getting someone else's money to spend on themselves. Mm. And, you know, when you move from one to four, things get pretty bad, you know, economically. But I think also to the credit of Milton Friedman, he also points out, you know, he obviously goes through details of the economics of it, of course, but he also points out, he kind of touches on public choice economics and, you know, just kind of, you know, the next round effects of, you know, like the rent seeking. But he points out this actually reduces the moral fabric of your economy and your society as well. Because, you know, essentially you're legalizing theft, essentially. You're legalizing envy and theft, ultimately. And these are just not good things that are going to play out in your society. So I wouldn't quite agree with you that we're that different from Africa, be it Australia or the U.S. I've seen, you know, I've watched over my lifetime, putting aside the fact I'm an economic historian as well, and I've looked at how, you know, in many ways society has deteriorated over the past 100 years, in many ways, and it's really deteriorated in recent years. And I've, you know, I know this is kind of getting off the point, but, you know, there's institutions in the U.S. who have really are, if they're not corrupt, they're certainly well on the path to that. And, you know, this is getting to, you know, institutions like the FBI and the Department of Justice. But remember, the Department of Justice doesn't just have the FBI. They also do antitrust. And there's a, you know, there's I could point out to you and your readers, sorry, your listeners, a great book on sort of the history of antitrust and how it actually has been largely just a tool, a political tool, and it hasn't really been used, you know, to genuinely deal with monopoly power.
Right. Okay. Well, I guess they arguably could have done more through history. I mean, what did they do? They broke up Standard Oil, and then was there a long hiatus or a long break? And then they broke up, was it AT&T? And now they're just getting on to looking at the power of Google and Facebook. Is that what you're saying, that they could have done more?
No. Well, look, what I'm saying is, you know, I think it's a flawed institution anyway, antitrust authorities. But even within the context of what they're supposed to doing, they haven't really done, you know, they've gone after, you know, so-called monopolies in marketplaces where the prices were still going down, you know, like Microsoft or Standard Oil. Both, you know, yeah, they both dominated their marketplace.
Mm.
But, you know, even, you know, I certainly know Australian sort of legislation well enough to know that, It's, you know, you don't actually just go after someone who's dominating a market. You have to go, well, what's happening with prices? You know, how is it actually impacting consumers? Yet they will still go after these companies for political reasons, you know, or bureaucrats who, you know, have like an axe to grind for whatever reason.
Yes. Well, I guess with Google and Facebook, it's challenging, isn't it? Because if you make that argument, it's just about you should just look at prices. Well, for consumers, I mean, we're not paying for these services. I mean, we're the product, aren't we? They're getting all of their money from, I guess if you look at what they're charging businesses for advertising, that's where you could argue that you'd have to argue there's that abuse of market power there.
Yeah, not just prices, but prices, you know, and then the quantity of the products and the quality of the product, all that. You have to go look at that. You can't just kind of like blindly go, oh, someone dominates the market, let's do something.
Yeah.
Google and Facebook, you know, that actually brings in all sorts of other stuff, obviously, besides just, you know, the arguments again, you know, sort of for taking on Microsoft or Standard Oil, because they have such a huge effect on the culture and democracy as well, which, you know, the others didn't. You know, there's other factors at play, like particularly in the U.S. to deal with the First Amendment and things like that, because, you know, sort of big tech have been censoring heavily for 6 months. I know I've personally seen it myself. I've had LinkedIn aren't as famous or infamous as Facebook and Twitter. But people go, well, you know, go try another competitor. Well, unfortunately, big tech then is in a position to take their competitors out like they did with Parler.
Right.
So,
yeah.
I don't know if we'll ever see Parler back. It all stems from, you know, from Section 230 and other sorts of advantages they've gotten and they've abused.
Yeah.
You know, abused.
Right. We'll have to revisit that again in another episode. Yeah, we'll have to follow up our surveillance capitalism episode from early last year. I think that's where you mentioned that Section 230. I think I learned about that from you, and then suddenly it became a huge issue last year. So, yeah.
But, you know, look, you know, like I said, Friedman and Rothbard and others also, you know, people love the culture wars, but the culture wars are not disconnected from these economic discussions as well. They're, you know, it takes that kind of cartels and monopoly power to have the extra cash to do all the stuff that big tech has been doing in the field of censorship and destroying their competitors.
Right. Okay. We might leave it there. Darren Brody Nielsen. Oh, I want to chat. I'll chat about that in a future episode. I just don't think we've got time for it now, unfortunately. I need to think of it.
Seeds.
I need to think a bit more about it. Okay.
Because, you know, I hope to get up to number 7, you know, and Tom Brady from yesterday, who's got up to 7 Super Bowls.
Oh, yeah. Right. Ah, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, being on your podcast is like, you know, having a Super Bowl win.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, one day, yes, you're here in the early days. Yes. You might, yes, absolutely. Hopefully we'll get to double figures over the years. Okay, Darren, thanks again for joining me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Economics Explored podcast. If you're enjoying it, please tell your family and friends, and please give us a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or on whatever platform you're listening on. If you'd like to get in touch with any comments or to ask any questions, please email me at gene.tunney@gmail.com. Until next week, goodbye.